Welcome to our Day 14 preview from the 2018 U.S. Open. I'm Brian Clark with Jay McManus and Matt Cronin. A special welcome to tennis fans around the world who are listening in on Courtside. It's the official podcast of the U.S. Open. Of course, Day 14, the focus there mainly on the Men's Singles Championship. Juan Martín Del Potro, the 2009 U.S. Open champion, back in the final 9 years after he won his first and to date only major tournament. His opponent is Novak Djokovic. He's won this U.S. Open several times before, and it was Del Potro getting through in a way that nobody wanted to see. That was Rafael Nadal having to retire, but the tennis world owed Del Potro some karma with the injuries that kept him out of several U.S. Opens, off the tour for years, a series of surgeries on his wrists, and he knows that it's just special to be back in the final of any major, let alone the U.S. Open.
And now I'm having a good present, looking forward for the future, and I didn't expect to get this kind of emotions playing tennis again and reaching finals, winning titles, having my highest ranking ever in this moment. So everything is almost perfect.
Yeah, he's the world number three right now. Hard to believe Djokovic is the world number six, but it's been two different years for Djokovic, Matt. There was everything before Wimbledon when he was still finding his way back, and there's been everything since Wimbledon when he won there, and then, of course, won Cincinnati to complete his Masters Slam, the only player to win every Masters 1000. Both of these players red hot coming into this final.
Well, I mean, look, Djokovic is almost 100% back. Won Wimbledon, won Cincinnati. He's played pretty well over the last 12 days, runs well, good. His backhand possibly is the best of all time, forehand's better, thinking about it. He's favored, there's no doubt about it. He's beaten Juan Martín many, many times. However, with Delpo, he's gotten better. He can finally hit his backhand, forehand's big, first serve, fairly fast. It could be five sets, could be.
There's a very good chance of that. And Jane, you know, it's Djokovic is probably the favorite, as Matt says. He's beaten him 14. Actually, right now, let's head downstairs. Serena Williams about to meet the media after her loss in the final.
Question. Yes, sir. Serena, what are the emotions? Obviously, a difficult night for you. I wonder if you could just talk about how you're feeling.
I don't know how I'm feeling yet. I haven't had time to really process everything, but I'm just trying, like I said, out there to stay positive and to, you know, look at all the bright things and all the good things and just keep going forward with that.
Serena, how did motherhood influence how you comforted Naomi today?
I don't know. I felt at one point I felt bad because I'm crying and she's crying and, you know, she just won, and I'm not sure if they were happy tears or they were just sad tears because of the moment. And, you know, I felt like, wow, this isn't how I felt when I won my first Grand Slam. So I was like, well, I definitely don't want her to feel like that. So, yeah, maybe it was the mom in me that was like, listen, we got to pull ourselves together here.
You are very graceful at the end, to not mention all what happened before, but Patrick Mouratoglou said that he gave you some sort of advice when you got the warning for coaching. Mm-hmm. So did you understand that? You didn't realize what went through?
So I don't know. I literally just heard that too, when they prepped me to come in. Yeah. And I just texted Patrick, like, what is he talking about? Because we don't have signals. We've never discussed signals. I don't even call for on-court coaching, so I'm trying to figure out why he would say that. I don't understand. I mean, maybe he said you can do it, but I was on the far other end, so I'm not sure. I want to clarify myself what he's talking about.
So the umpire had to give you the coaching.
Excuse me?
The umpire had to give you the
I wasn't being coached. If I look at my box and they say come on or good job, then and I don't know what else to do. At that point, after that, I didn't even look at my box anymore.
Serena, I know you talk about as a mother these teachable moments. When Alexis is old enough, how will you explain to her what happened out there tonight?
So there you could hear from Serena herself. It seems
honestly,
like there might be some discord in the Williams camp, where Patrick Mouratoglou, he told ESPN in an interview that, okay, he was giving her signals, but saying that everybody does it. Serena's saying, no, he was not giving me signals. So that seems like something that's going to have to be ironed out.
That controversial will continue. Has to.
Absolutely. Or yeah. It could be ended quickly if Serena, you know, says a couple of words to her coach, Jane.
I think Patrick Mouratoglou has some explaining to do. Is, you know, it's like Ricky Ricciardo over there. He's got some explaining to do.
Many years ago.
You know, from the tone there, I think of Serena Williams being very diplomatic about it, but emphatic because what that, when he said that, he obviously undermines her assertion that there was no coaching going on. And I think it's very important for her tonight, as you could see in her intensity level about this issue, to make sure that people understand there was no coaching going on. And so that comment throws a wrench in it, unfortunately, for Serena Williams. But, you know, obviously she's doing her best to kind of get over what was a very difficult loss and a very emotional loss.
And that was to Naomi Osaka. But let's get back to previewing the men's final. It's Novak Djokovic, the three-time U.S. Open champion, against Juan Martín Del Potro. And talking about Del Potro's road back, we talk about Djokovic's road back, both out of the game for injuries. But Del Potro's match set is going to be the favorite, but Djokovic is going to be the favorite. But Del Potro is such a popular player, especially here at the U.S. Open. And Djokovic himself was even able to recognize that and knows that.
He's a gentle giant, you know. He's very tall and has a big game, but at the same time, he nurtures the right values in life. He cares about his family, he cares about his friends. He respects everyone. He fights every match from the first to the last point, and I think people can relate to that and they appreciate what he brings to the tennis. And he treats others as the way he wants others to treat him, and I think that's why people love him.
And everybody does love Juan Martín Del Potro, the 2009 U.S. Open champion. That's when he ended Roger Federer's run of five consecutive titles. And as we celebrate Naomi Osaka at 20 years old for beating Serena, you thought at the time, okay, this is going to be the first of many for Del Potro. Injuries and some tough losses have
Seriously.
Said no. But this is his best chance. It's hard to believe. Not only has he not won since, he's not been back to a major final since that 2009 championship, Jane.
What I found interesting in his last press conference, you know, with that semifinal win, was that he talked about possibly leaving tennis altogether, and not just leaving tennis, but putting an end to the amount of surgeries that he was having on his wrist. I believe he's had four surgeries, and you know, that's just a lot to put your body through. And you know, when you talk about an individual sport and what players go through in order to be ready to play and to play at a high level, you know, it's very tricky to be able to, when you're using that much power and you're exerting that much power with a forehand, to be able to make sure that the integrity of your arm is 100% all the time. And you just think about, like, just over the lifetime of a career, and to have been to a place where he wasn't even going to have another surgery, to being in the final at the U.S. Open, that is a long road.
Well, you just go back all to 2009 when he was in the final. He could hit with his backhand, didn't break it at that point. It was an unbelievable two-hander. That's why he won. Remember, he beat Federer in the fifth set in the final. I think it was 6-2 in the fifth. Before that, 6-2, 6-2, 6-2 over Rafa. At that point, you're thinking he could win so many slams, but then he got seriously hurt, and that was 9 years ago. But even last year, you could tell his backhand was coming back better, right? Forehand is incredible. His big serve, too. Moving forward, thinking about it, and obviously Djokovic has beaten him so many times. However, Juan Martín has an opportunity to throw it over there. Could.
He absolutely does. And Del Potro, knowing that Djokovic is his opponent, has a different kind of take on things.
It will be a difficult match because we are close friends. And for sure, we both want to win. But Novak has won the Wimbledon already. He's playing so good, and he will be the favorite to win on Sunday. But I don't know. When I played Roger 9 years ago, he was the favorite to win as well. And I will try to make the surprise again.
And of course, he did beat Federer, as we just talked about, but when he's played Djokovic, it's been pretty much one-way traffic. They've played 18 times. Djokovic has won 14
it's a lot.
Of those matches. So you would certainly say Djokovic is the favorite in Sunday's final.
But he did actually, the last three times, it was Djokovic won, but 4 year time was in Olympics.
Yep, in Rio.
And he pulled it off.
Yeah, two tie breaks.
Yep, so that was good. I mean, he has a chance. Really, he just has to do something different. I'm just not sure how he's going to pull it off, but he does need big serves and certainly the forehand, because backhand to backhand, Novak's just going to crush it.
Well, they haven't met yet this year. And, you know, so that I think, you know, means a new, you know, new surface, new year. That'll throw a little bit of a wrench in it. But that, yes, they're so familiar with each other. And Djokovic has just been playing so well this tournament. The conditions that affected him early on are not going to be a factor. The weather will be nice and cool. So, you know, when we did see him get worn down and exhausted and, you know, almost it looked like a bit dehydrated in some of those matches, that's not going to be a factor.
And that will be the Sunday final. One of two Sunday finals will also crown the women's doubles champion. Second-seeded pairing of Tomeo Babos and Kristina Mladenovic take on the American Coco Vandeweghe and Ash Barty, the Australian who spent some time away from the game trying to play professional cricket, needed a break from tennis, but now she is back and in the U.S. Open women's doubles final. They are the 13th-seeded team. So that gets underway at noon Eastern on day 14 of this U.S. Open. So what a day 13 it was. It was not short on drama at all. And also, we do want to tip our caps to the mixed doubles champions, as we just talked about the women's doubles final. That was Jamie Murray, Bethany Maddox-Sands. Maddox-Sands, of course, just over a year removed from that gruesome knee injury, beating Nicola Metkic and Alicia Rosolska 2-6, 6-3, and then winning the match tiebreak 11-9. Very exciting capper to the mixed doubles competition and a very dramatic end to the women's singles championship, where it was Naomi Osaka taking down Serena Williams. That is our day 14 preview. For Jay McManus and Matt Cronin, I'm Brian Clark. Thanks for listening. You can join us for complete live coverage on U.S. Open Radio presented by American Express. You can find us on usopen.org or the U.S. Open app.
Celebrating 50 years of the U.S. Open with the one and only Chrissy Evert. Chrissy, welcome and thanks for joining me today.
Steve, thank you for asking me.
Now, let's start, Chrissy, let's go back to the 71 Open. Now, you had had a stunning victory over Margaret Court when you were 15 in 1970, just a couple weeks after Margaret had won the Grand Slam. But in many ways, you launched your career by that run to the semifinals as a 16-year-old and at the U.S. Open of 1971. And during that two-week stretch, you had three remarkable comebacks against Marianne Eisel, Frankie Durer, and Leslie Hunt. And the Eisel match, of course, was the standout because she was serving for the match up triple match point at 6-5, 40-love in the second set. And somehow you saved six match points altogether and won it. Try to put all that into perspective. A 16-year-old playing your first major tournament, having still been combining juniors and women's events that summer, and here you are making this incredible splash in New York.
Well, I was a kid. You know, I was a kid, and it was my first, like you said, it was my first U.S. Open, and I think I'd won the 18 Nationals by that time, and,
yep.
You know, like you said, I'd started to play some women's tournaments, but I think the U.S. Open, that was the start of my career, no doubt, just because the drama of it, and I remember that they put me on center court every single match, which was kind of cool. And my first round was against Etta Budding, right?
Yes,
Etta
correct, Budding. Correct.
And was that 6-love, 6-love, or was that 6-love, 6-1?
Yeah, you lost one game.
Oh, it was 6-love, 6-1, right?
Yeah.
But at that time, I think she was the number one German player. And for me, you know, to win that easily at the U.S. Open, it kind of like opened my eyes a little bit to the fact that I could play, you know, with the big girls. But as you mentioned, that match with Marianne Eisel, even as I look back now, I don't know how the heck I got through that match. And, you know, all I can say is that I never felt any pressure, even on the match points. You know, I just, it was not a big deal. If I lost, I lost. And I didn't, put any pressure on myself. I remember thinking that the ball looked bigger than usual on when I was match point down, because I think I was down 6 match points.
Yes, and, correct.
And, you know, again, just I just went for my shots, and I think after that was really the big match. I don't know what would have happened if I would have lost that match. I mean, because I just think that getting to the semifinals at the U.S. Open really set the tone for the rest of my career. Not that I wouldn't have had a great career, but it would be interesting to see what would have happened. It might not have happened. I might not have had a great year or two after that. I don't know. So I got through the match with Marion Issel, and then I remember...
Do you remember that it was televised, you know, Bud Collins in the booth?
I do remember, and yeah. I've YouTubed it. I've gone back and listened to it, too. It's pretty funny to hear Bud Collins commentating. And then the next round was that...
Francois Durr. Yeah.
And then every match had a drama, because Frankie Durr, after I beat her, you know, she was like in tears. She was in tears on the court because the crowds were so pro me being young and being an American and encouraging me to do well. And she was just so frustrated. She's, you know, a French player. She was so emotional anyway. So I remember she was in tears on the court. And then Leslie Hunt, again, you know, really a serve and volleyer, very much like Marion Issel, a serve and volleyer and really tough grass court player. But I got, you know, got past her. By then, there was just so much publicity. And I was staying with my aunt and uncle, with my mom and my aunt and uncle out in Larchmont. So I had like, an hour and a half drive. Every day, we didn't even stay in the city. We had an hour and a half drive every day, driving to the U.S. Open and back. And they were making me make my bed and take the dishes out of the dishwasher and do the dishes. And, you know, I was not that I shouldn't, but I mean, staying in a hotel, you kind of have privileges where you're not doing these things. And, you know, I was still living like, you know, a 16-year-old girl, but yet I was becoming a star, I think, that those 2 weeks at the U.S. Open. So by the time I reached the semifinals, I mean, it was crazy. It was crazy.
Now, were you reading the newspapers every morning or watching the news at
you
night?
You know, I was, but it didn't faze me at all. You know, it just didn't faze me at all. It was like I was winning tennis matches, and that's really the perspective that I had. I was winning tennis matches, and I made the front page of the New York Times. You know, I was like, okay, that's really nice, you know. But in my own way, I didn't get carried away with myself, and it did not put extra pressure on me.
And not intimidated by being interviewed by Howard Cosell.
No, well, that was after the Billie Jean match, wasn't it?
Yes.
Was that after I lost?
That's true.
What was intimidating was going into the press room with you guys after my matches, because, you know, I really wasn't versed on any prep. I mean, I didn't have any preparation for that or any training for that. And it was like people were sticking microphones in my face and asking me these questions. And all my replies were, you know, I felt really good. I didn't feel nervous. And I just went out there and I played well. And I mean, it's just the simplest answers, but you know, I think that was really intimidating, because I felt like I was in a room full of some very intelligent, probing people that wanted to know more than I was willing to give out.
And it was hard not to be a little robotic at times, wasn't it? I mean, you weren't used to doing these press conferences.
No, it was. I was like a fish out of water, and my answers were one sentence, and I didn't really want to talk about, you know, my school and my family life. And yeah, I really, it was like, whoa, you know, you can ask me about the match or what. So that was very intimidating. But my match with Billie Jean, you know, I remember that was really special. And we're walking out, this is at Forest Hills, so, you know, we didn't have bodyguards to walk out. I mean, we walked the whole length from the locker room to center court. And when we walked, there were people on both sides of us roped off, but you know, there's a lot of people. And Billie Jean, I remember when we were walking out, she said to me, "You're riding on the crest of a wave, enjoy it." And of course, as 16, I didn't know what the heck she was talking about. and I remember that.
Yeah, but did you think she was trying to psych you out in a way, or was that just conversation?
Yeah. I thought that she was trying to get into my head a little bit, because as junior players, nobody ever talked to each other when they're walking out to the matches. You know, we didn't talk to each other. So I thought, okay, fine. Oh, thank you. But, you know, now be quiet so I can go play my match. So we went out there, and I remember thinking, you know, Billie Jean, I mean, she beat me by just playing smart tennis. She beat me by slices and dices and topspin and drop shots. And she didn't overpower me. And I don't know, she just outsmarted me. She just took away my rhythm. And I couldn't play my game at all. I couldn't find my timing. She took away all of my strengths. But she was very, very smart about it. And the other women, they just tried to power through me. That hadn't worked. So I think she specifically thought before the match, specifically what kind of strategy. And she changed because she didn't play other women this way. She didn't play other players the way she played me that match in the semifinals.
But she didn't really have a choice, right? I mean, I think in a way she felt that there was no alternative, because if she didn't mix things up and if she wasn't creative, you were going to beat her.
No, for sure. I'm complimenting her on how smart she was and the tactics that she did use. And it was, again, I was surprised that she was hitting the ball soft, and I was surprised that she was hitting it with a lot of slice. But as the match went on, I realized as I looked at the scoreboard that it was working. So I didn't feel like I got blown off the court, but I felt like I definitely got outsmarted. And then when I lost that match, then I was interviewed by Howard Cosell. And again, the press conference was another intimidating press conference. But, you know, that it was a Cinderella story, you know, quite frankly. I mean, that was my first tournament what a great tournament to blossom at, and to come at to having a coming out party at the U.S. Open, your own country's championship. You know, couldn't have been more ideal. It couldn't have been more perfect for me. And ironically, I was invited the year before when I was 15 to play the U.S. Open, because that was the year I won the 18 Nationals when I was 15, and the 18 National champion got right into the main draw. And I remember my dad turned and said, no, she's not ready. So he thought I was ready that year when I was 16, and he was right.
Absolutely. Well, Chrissy, you were still an amateur that year in 71. You didn't turn pro until you turned 18, but could you have envisioned at that stage this soaring prize money, this game that was taking off, particularly the women's game, because the Virginia Slim Circuit had really just started that year. The nine players had signed their contracts in 70, and now in 71, the year that you got to the semis of the Open, that was the first year, really, of the tour. I mean, could you have ever envisioned then, at that age, where everything was headed?
No. But remember, I was only 16, so it's like I had lived the circuit before that. You know, I really wasn't that familiar. All I was familiar with was junior tennis and then women's tennis for just a couple of years. But no, I wouldn't have envisioned it to have taken off the way that it did. But again, my dad, who was my coach, my father, made all the decisions for me at that time. At 16, I wasn't really educated and aware, and I didn't see the social aspect of what women were going through and equality, and I didn't understand that, you know, the women were receiving 10% of the prize money of men. I mean, I thought, you know, I understood it, but I just thought women athletes are relatively, that was kind of a new concept, and they'll work their way into it and get equal prize money sooner or later. But at that point, it was so uneven. But again, I was so young that I am protected that I didn't know the full consequences of the movement. What was going on in the early 70s with women?
So you went home, but you obviously, when you left the Open.
Oh my gosh, went home.
You're trying to digest it all, and did you really feel pretty soon thereafter that your life might have changed forever? That was a lot to get a hold of.
Yeah, I felt it did for sure, because I went home, I flew home, and the whole school came out to meet me at the airport. So I guess so. You know, the band was there, and the school was there, and as I got off the plane, they announced, Chris Evert, please wait until the end, you know, the last person to get off the plane. So I got off last, and I went back to the school, and I had to make a speech, and the next day Life magazine came to my class and took pictures. So I knew at that point that my life had changed and that I was going to be under the microscope. I mean, even at that young of an age, I felt like I was going to be living under a microscope from there on in.
Well, no doubt about it. I mean, you had become a celebrity very, very swiftly mm-hmm. there. But let's move ahead to this, to the your first victory at the Open in 75, because by then, your career had totally taken off, and you're number one in the world, and you'd already won a couple of French, and you'd won Wimbledon in 74 the year before.
Yeah.
But now this was the year that the U.S. Open switched to clay, or Hartshoe to be more exact, and you hadn't lost on clay for a couple of years, and it all came down to this enthralling three-set final between you and the carefree Yvonne Goolagong, and you fought back to win it 6-2 in the third. Talk about the gratitude of winning your country's championships for the first time, and also the sight of your mother sobbing in the stands when it was over.
I know. Oh, my heavens. I remember, first of all, playing Yvonne was always tough because she's such a wonderfully natural athlete, and I find myself watching her, the way she moves and the way she hits the ball with such grace, and I had to keep telling myself, watch the ball, don't look at her. She was such a great player, but winning that, I did feel pressure in that match because I always thought that I was a better clay court player than Yvonne and that I should win that match. But after I pulled out that match, I remember looking up and seeing my mom, not with a few tears, but sobbing. And I was like, whoa. And I was the kind of player that, you know, I kept everything in and I didn't show emotions. And I looked up and I saw her sobbing. And I'm like, that's probably the way I should have been feeling, but I wasn't. But I realized how much it meant to her to have her, to see her daughter, you know, win a major championship. And I think, that took precedent over me winning. It's just seeing that. It still is with me today.
Courtside, the official podcast of the U.S. Open. Thank you for listening all year to our celebration of 50 years of the U.S. Open.